Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, we are going to talk about medical technology with an expert, Dr. Joe Kim, who really knows everything about medical smartphones. Pretty interesting, huh, Christy?
Yeah, I'm excited to talk with him.
Okay, we're going to find out things that we don't know very much about, which will be interesting, hopefully. And we're going to talk about some research that matters about fruit salad and checking your blood sugar and money and weight loss. And also, we're going to talk with our great weekend warrior, Dr. Tim Taft.
We are. I'm looking forward to that. The first article is about, is for anyone out there who has diabetes or a loved one with diabetes.
And you got to check their blood sugar. And you prick your finger and you get a reading that says 240 and you say, oh, it's really high. Is that the case?
Right. Well, this was a study looking at patients who have diabetes and peeled fruit around the time that they took their blood sugar and the effect of that on
like
the
orange.
Reading. Yeah.
Like peeling
so you
an
peel
orange.
An orange, peel a banana, peel, I think an orange would be more significant, but something where you're getting fruit on your hands. And then what happens when then you take a needle and prick your finger and the reading it gives you on your blood sugar?
Yeah, this was in the journal Diabetes Care, and they found, I thought this was going to be like, oh, ho, so what? But they found actually that the readings, and these were healthy volunteers, but that their readings went up significantly after they had peeled this compared to where they were, readings that could be, you know, order of magnitude higher, which we would say would be clinically relevant.
Yeah, and it basically, the people who washed their hands right afterwards had no major spikes in their blood sugar, but the ones who still had fruit juice or fruit on their fingers, it makes sense that it would be higher.
And wiping your fingers with alcohol didn't really do it. You had to really wash your hands.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a new question to ask. As we're doctors, to ask you as listeners if you have diabetes, and also for you to tell your family and friends to know that not to peel fruit and then check your blood sugar.
Yeah, wash your hands first.
Great.
The next one is about money and weight loss.
Ooh, this is very, very interesting, Christy.
Yeah, this is a study in the Journal of General Internal Medicine to see if the idea that you would earn money from our weight loss program would help you lose weight more effectively than just a routine weight loss program.
Yeah, these people who kind of trying to lose weight were given a standard behavioral program, but then also they were given a thing whereby they could put up a little bit of money, and the researchers also put up money in an account. And each day that they kind of met their goals, they accumulated money. And at the end of the 6 to 8 month period of time, did they lose more weight than those who didn't have that sort of financial incentive?
Yeah, it's pretty neat that the people lost more weight who were in the group that had the financial incentives. But after 9 months after the program ended, those people had gained back most of their weight.
Yeah, and
so
only
kind of wore off.
And less than about 10% actually met that goal over the whole length of the study of a pound per week. I don't know about you, Christy, but I do think that there is something about incentives. But, you know, this almost was a negative incentive. You're going to lose something, you know, here versus just totally positive that you're going to give something away or something. So I actually have a challenge for you, Christy. Actually, it's for me, too.
Okay, let's hear it.
Which is an incentive for us to not necessarily lose weight, because you're real thin. I could use to lose a little pounds.
Thin.
But I think a fitness challenge here that we could maybe do a challenge where over a month, if we would try to do 1 million steps, which is a little over 10,000 a day, which is kind of a recommended threshold for pretty active fitness.
It's a lot of steps.
That's a lot of steps, a million steps over a month.
A million.
Starting up on the beginning of March and the end of the month, seeing—
You're going to pay me?
Well, I'm not going to pay you, but I'd suggest that each of us could give away some money. We each have a charity, and if we don't do it, then we double what we're going to give to the charity. We'll give away some money regardless.
Right.
We'll each pick a charity. What do you think?
I'll take it. I mean, I don't even come close to that number of steps right now, but I need to exercise more. I've admitted on the radio that I don't exercise. So I'll take your challenge, Adam. So then we'll give to charity at the end of the month.
Yeah, we'll each pick a charity. We'll let folks know. We'll maybe listen from our listeners where they might recommend. But we'll use a positive financial incentive here. Maybe it's positive.
Maybe. Okay, I'll do it.
And we'll get our Weekend Warrior to also challenge and get him involved.
But, that's a great idea.
Well, let's listen to and see. We'll bring our Weekend Warrior back on the show.
Okay.
Dr. Tim Taft, Director of Sports Medicine, as far as I know it, for all of UNC. I know there's lots of people out there. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Taft.
Well, I'm happy to be here. Now, Adam, we got a problem. I'm no longer the director.
Oh, no. So we can call you the former director.
The former director. That, you know, about a year and a half ago, I entered this phased retirement program, and one of the stipulations for that is that you have to give up administrative responsibility and kicking and screaming. Yeah, right. Throw me in that briar patch. I stepped down from those administrative duties, so that's not a perfectly accurate.
So does that mean we don't have to pay you the double the salary that we were?
Got it.
We
thought. Yeah.
you still are the main team physician for Tar Heel basketball team.
Yeah, I'm the senior orthopedic consultant or senior orthopedist, and I still work with the team.
Well, we're glad to have you. And actually, one of the things we were Christy and I were talking about, because it's been so much in the news, we wanted to get your thoughts on it. You know, the probably one of the top basketball players that could have been in the country this year over at our arch rival nemesis, Duke, has had an injury all year long. And it's been kind of quiet, but if you go behind the scenes, people talk about this thing called turf toe. And I thought, oh my goodness, I should know everything about turf toe. And there was, I don't know anything about turf toe. And I thought, we should get you on the show and just tell us, this is an injury that seems to be affecting one of the star athletes in the country. It must be important.
Well, it's important because it is very painful, and it makes it difficult for the athlete to start, stop, cut, pivot, land from jumping. And, you know, it's hard to do almost any sporting or athletic activity if your feet hurt. And this is a very sore, painful big toe that he apparently had.
So the term turf toe sounds like a football problem. Tell us, what is a turf toe?
A turf toe is a term that was coined, maybe a decade or two ago, and was indeed a football, had a football origin. And it first started when we started spending more and more time on the artificial surfaces that were somewhat harder. And that's where the term came from, is that it tended to occur primarily in football players who were playing on the artificial rather than the natural surfaces.
So the turf refers to the surface, not that you've kind of scorched your toe and rubbing it the wrong way.
Absolutely. It came from the surface that you were playing on, and it usually kind of sneaks up on you. When the players have been on those hard surfaces for a period of time, they start getting some soreness in the main joint of the big toe. That gets progressively worse. Then they may stub their toe as part of their sporting activity and have a sudden aggravation of that. And it takes a frustratingly long period of time to calm down.
So is this the problem with the joint or problem with the tendons, or what part of the toe is affected?
The current feeling is that it is probably the capsule, which is the fibrous membrane that surrounds the toe joint itself. Mm-hmm. There may be some involvement of the joint surface, the cartilage, on the joint surface. Usually there is not a tendon involvement per se, but the exact pathology, the exact tissue that's causing the problem is under some discussion.
You know, this seems like one of those weird injuries. First off, I must say that it seems like, how can the one big toe affect our star athletes in such ways that they can't perform? Because you see you get that sprained ankle and they're back on the court in a week later, or they've done something worse and they're in a cast. And here it's kind of like never, never land.
Well, and it must hurt pretty darn bad to be taking these high athletes out of action.
Well, and the problem you have is that if you make the mistake and have the person go back too soon, if they go back before they're ready, then they re-aggravate the injury and you're starting all over again. So One of the mistakes that you can make when you have this kind of an injury is that you can think you're doing okay. You've treated the person with rest and some form of immobilization. You may or may not have used some kind of medications to try to decrease the amount of inflammation. They seem to be doing kind of okay, and then you try to let them go back too soon, and they stub their toe again, or they land on it awkwardly, and then you're back to square one. So you've got to be cautious about getting somebody like this back to activity too soon.
Those are really tough decisions.
Got to be patient. That's not most of our nature.
Well, and especially mid-season, or at the beginning of the season like this. No, we call these folks patients, but most of us don't have it.
Well, we wish him well, and boy, we have to thank you for being with us today to explain something that I'm sure thousands of listeners, if not millions around the country, really don't know much about. So thanks for letting us know a little bit more.
Thanks, Dr. Taft.
Well, thank you very much, and I've enjoyed chatting with you.
That concludes the Weekend Warriors portion of our show. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, we will be talking with medical technology expert and physician Dr. Joe Kim about health apps and medical smartphones. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking with Dr. Joe Kim about health apps and medical smartphones.
Yeah, those are some fancy words, Christy, but they're ones that you and I live every day and our colleagues live, and increasingly is such an important part of patient care that we decided we really needed to bring on an expert to help us understand and help listeners understand this interface between the doctor and the patient that relies on technology here. We're very fortunate to have with us today Dr. Joe Kim. Dr. Kim is Vice President of Medical Affairs and Technology at Medical Communications Media, as well as the founder of nonclinicaljobs.com and the Society of Physicians with Nonclinical Careers. Welcome to the show, Dr. Kim.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Kim, reading your resume, I just wondered, as a person going into medical school, did you know you would have a career not seeing patients, this career in health technology, or did that develop along the way?
It developed along the way. I studied mechanical engineering in my undergrad, and so I was not your typical pre-med type of student. And I would say that along the way, I found greater opportunities in areas related to health technology, medical education, as well as just things that really aligned along with my passions. And so that's where I found myself after all these years. I really do enjoy what I'm doing now.
Well, tell us a little bit about the things that you are doing now, because I think, for our average listener who goes to the doctor and has an encounter, they may not appreciate the changed environment and landscape that's interacting with them as patients.
Sure. So some of the things that I'm involved in, I work in a company where we develop continuing medical education programs and activities for physicians, nurses, pharmacists, and other healthcare professionals. As most people know, these professionals require continuing education credits on a regular basis to renew their licensure to have the ability to continue to practice. And so I'm involved in developing education for them, as well as on the side, as a hobby, really talking with physicians about the use of technology in the clinical setting. So whether that be an electronic health record, a computer at the bedside, to a smartphone that they carry in their coat pocket, to some other form of technology, whether it be telemedicine, remote health. Those are the things that I find myself very interested in. I write about these things, I blog about them, and I really do enjoy talking to other healthcare professionals about the ways that they are using these technologies as they directly care for patients.
So thinking about, how a patient might see this in the office, my patient may ask about a medicine or we may be changing medicines, and I might just pull out my phone, same phone I use to call my kids or, order a pizza, and pull up a registry. It's called Hippocrates, what most doctors use. It has all the medicines, how to dose them, what the side effects are, interactions, all this information right there that doctors often use right there in their with their patient to show them that information or to help guide their decisions. And that sometimes can get in the way of a patient encounter, might make it faster. What do we know about how that affects patient care?
Sure. So I think one of the great ways that these kinds of tools are being used right at the point of care is that sometimes, as we know, patients forget which medicines they're on, and perhaps they're going to see a new doctor or they're going to see a specialist for consultation, and they remember that it's that pink pill, it's round, it's got the you know, scoring line down the middle. And the nice thing is that some of these tools, like Hippocrates, as well as some others, have the ability for the healthcare professional, the physician, to actually enter in the fact that it's round, that it's got a line, that it's pink, and then show the patient, is it this pill, is it that pill, and then from there to actually be able to identify what pill that patient is actually taking. And that, I think, to me, is just a very tangible example of one way that at that point of care, that healthcare professional can engage the patient and actually help retrieve some very important medical information by using these kinds of tools.
Well, you know, one of the things that I know when I went to medical school wasn't really, it was like a closely guarded secret that they didn't tell you to after you got out into practice and you were alone, is that you have to constantly read every day and frequently every other patient, if not more. And so the ability to read while you're essentially giving clinical care, and because there's questions you have to learn and study quickly, tell us a little bit about how the technology that you review helps this real down-to-earth common thing that no one talks about, which is you have to look up things and read about them.
Right. So I think one of the greatest examples is just that today we wake up, we get inundated with emails. There are so many alerts that fly out from the FDA, from different news sites. And I think that there's two ways that we as busy physicians may retrieve information. One is that we actually go out and we look for it, and the other way is that that information actually gets pushed to us, and it gets sent to us onto our mobile devices, that it either pops up as an alert, as a warning, or perhaps when we have a few minutes of downtime, we're able to just quickly glance through and review a few things. So I think that more and more busy physicians are staying current with the things that are being shared on the news, for instance, so that when their patient comes in saying, "Doctor, did you hear about that recall that the FDA just talked about?" the doctor is actually aware of what that patient's talking about.
And yeah, so
there are probably several examples of those kinds of tools that they can use.
Yeah, like the New England Journal of Medicine, I get, and maybe most doctors, I get their weekly alert of the titles and maybe the abstract, so I can, within a minute or two, and not have to go outside of my phone to see what's coming out in the news in the next 24 hours.
Exactly, right. And even social media tools like Twitter, which I know that there are still many physicians who don't use these kinds of social tools.
But there are lots of us who do.
Well, exactly. And I was going to say that, you know, following, for instance, the FDA or the CDC on Twitter and getting their alerts on your phone can actually keep you abreast of what's going on from even these agencies.
Or even just signing on to when I'm talking about this drug registry, Hippocrates, if I sign on to look for a medicine, it's not like I have a book from 2 years ago. I have this information that's being updated all the time from the sky. And it is the most up-to-date information if there's been a warning that came out about a medication. And even when I sign on, there's some alerts right at the very beginning that might trigger me to know about, you know, whatever the new news is related to medications. And that's so helpful to us, so different than having a book that you've carried around for 20 years.
Exactly. I think that today's physician, I should say a large percentage of today's physicians, they're probably relying more on search engines like Google to actually look up medical information as opposed to going to their textbooks. And I think that's both good and bad in the sense that the information they may find from Google might not always be accurate. And so it's critical that physicians know how to differentiate what's reliable source of information, what's not. And in fact, that is also just as critical, if not more, for patients. because many patients are actually relying on the internet to look for information.
And those are two skills that I think are different in teaching today's physicians than it was before, and that we have to, in training young doctors is a big part of my job, we have to teach them how to navigate those visits where patients may have come up with their own diagnosis that might be right and might not be, and also how to, if you're going to use Google, how to sort out what is junk and not reliable and what is actually reliable information that you can depend on.
Absolutely. And that's especially becoming true in today's world of social media and sharing information, where we have seen examples where people have circulated erroneous information to thousands of people. It's caught on with viral marketing. It's literally spread across the globe, and it's all erroneous health information. So we really do need to be very cautious.
So how do we teach new generations of learners, or maybe it's the new generations of learners teaching the older generations, to do this? Are there curriculum that we use? Are there training programs? Do we know what really works, or is it just happening?
It's just happening, I would say. And I think that we're going to start seeing some best practices emerging, but I don't think that we're going to find any structured curricula out there that really handles this. This is a continually evolving area.
Because, there was just a big research article about Facebook and physicians disclosing there's some personal information on Facebook. And so it's not only the use of this, it's also our interaction with these
exactly.
tools.
Right. But once again, it's going to continue to change. Let's just hope that we continue to stay on top of all the evolving issues.
Well, we do need to take a short break, but Dr. Kim, when we come back, I'm hoping to ask about some applications that patients might be able to use to help them navigate their own health. We'll be right back with UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health Radio with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with medical technology expert and physician Dr. Joe Kim about really this transformation of technology into the doctor-patient encounter. And Dr. Kim, right before we broke, Christy brought up a really good question, which is, it seems as if a tremendous amount of these applications are directed towards the physician, which then to benefit patients. But if I'm a listener out there and I'm a patient, can it go the other way? And how does it go the other way that our listeners and patients derive these same knowledge? Do they buy Hippocrates? Do they subscribe to it? Or are there other ways that information flows upstream?
Like health yeah. apps for patients.
Sure. I think that there are several things going on today. And the first, obviously, is that we have sophisticated patients who are researching these health apps. They're downloading them. They're trying them out. They're experimenting, and then they're sharing about their experience. And I think this is working well in areas where the apps are general enough. For instance, apps that encourage exercise, they're fitness-focused, or perhaps they deal with healthy nutrition and eating, and it's for people who want to lose weight.
And there's tons, tons of these out there, right?
Right, exactly. There are tons of them.
And some of them are commercial. I mean, there's a Weight Watchers app that I use that I love, but I would imagine there are others that you have to purchase or others that are free that you could just download and track your exercise or something.
Exactly. There are commercial apps. There are even some made by pharmaceutical companies. I think the key thing that the consumer needs to be aware of, though, is that their privacy and their information might get compromised depending on who the developer is of the app.
Hmm.
So if there's a no-name organization or company, or in some cases it's an international company, well, that app potentially has access to a lot of your personal information on your phone, on your device. And I think most of us breeze through the little privacy statements that we have to check off before we actually install the app.
The 65 pages of electronic.
Scroll down
to the
check.
I think that people don't realize what could potentially happen with this information. And
let's talk about that for a second. I know one of the concerns as a provider is that you are directing people to applications that may be diagnosing and or offering treatment suggestions, and that carries for a lot of physicians medical legal risk. Could you address how that works in some of the application markets?
Yeah, I think that the number of physicians that I've spoken with who do see patients, especially those in primary care, are very hesitant to actually recommend a disease-specific app for exactly that reason. If the patient misuses the app and if it causes some kind of a problem, suppose it's an insulin dosing app for someone with diabetes, who ultimately is going to be held liable, especially if there's documentation in the chart that the patient was recommended this app from the physician?
So then the patient might, you're saying if they're logging their insulin and they're dosing and then this app tells them they should give this many units and they give it and something bad happens, is
right.
it the app's fault, the patient's fault, or the doctor for referring them there?
Or all of the above. And I think these are some of the things that are causing physicians to be very hesitant to actually recommend a specific app, to endorse an app, or to do anything along those lines. So I think that we are still in the early times because these apps are not FDA regulated. I mean, recently there was an app actually approved by the FDA, but it was for professional imaging, for radiologists. And the FDA is not regulating apps that consumers are using. So there's a lot of hesitancy to know exactly where these apps should fit from a provider talking to a patient saying that, yes, you know what, here's an app that might actually help you.
Well, thinking about that application, sorry, Adam, I'm cutting you off there, but it's exciting to think that could be an area of new research to prove that, I mean, what there may be an app that really does help people manage their blood sugar better, that really might have better outcomes.
Absolutely. I mean, for instance, there are apps out there that just help remind you to take your pills. It's a medication adherence reminder app saying that if you take this one pill 3 times a day, it'll set these alerts and alarms on your phone. And until you check off saying that, yes, I've taken my pill, it's going to continue to remind you.
Kind of like your seatbelt. Your seatbelt
exactly.
In your car. Yeah.
Ding,
right.
Ding.
And I think that given that more and more patients are taking multiple pills, they're taking them at different times of the day, these kinds of apps can be very valuable. But we need to use some common sense. I mean, if the phone runs out of battery or if the patient forgets the phone and then forgets to take the pills, I don't think we can really hold the app developer or even the physician who recommended the app liable. But these are some of the fears that people have. And so that's kind of the environment that we're in right now.
Well, I know you on your website, which is actually a very good website just to kind of get solid information about what's happening in trends. You have an article up there about that doctors are going to replace stores like the iPhone App Store as the main distribution channel for mobile health applications within 3 to 4 years. That seems remarkable, talking about doctors and hospitals, because it suggests that despite this fear of litigation and others, what's going to drive that? Why?
Well, I think part of it, I think part of what's happening today is that there are certain centers out there, medical centers, that have really embraced social media. They've embraced the patient health record, that whole empowered consumer mentality. They want to educate that consumer. They want to communicate with them on a regular basis, and they want to do all of this digitally. So if we look at some of these organizations and we see what they're doing in the space of social media and interactions, they're actually really leveraging this, and a number of them are actually doing research on this as well to see how it's impacting patient care.
Like what Christy just mentioned, huh?
Right. Those are really the ones on the forefront, on the leading edge, that I think will find the answers as to how this is really going to be able to help.
So do you have several apps right now, mobile apps or other, that you think are really cutting edge? Give us an example of a couple that are cutting edge, and what do they do?
It's tough to say that there's any that are really cutting edge, because what most of them really boil down to is that they take a lot of the capabilities that are found online on a regular website, and then they sort of boil them down and make it available on your handheld. So, for instance, a BMI calculator for a body mass index, that's nothing really cutting edge. You can find that almost anywhere online. But to have access to that kind of resource or some kind of a calorie counter right at the point of care so that you don't, when you're going out to eat or perhaps right before an appointment, you can look these things up and have access to that kind of information right in your pocket. I think that is what makes the cutting edge.
And to transfer that, to email it to a patient right there in front of in the room that you've just emailed them an app that they can count their own BMI.
Exactly, right. And the other other thing that's really going on today is the secure messaging portals that some of these medical institutions are using that allow them to communicate safely and securely with their patients. They can send a patient a text or an email saying, please log into your secure portal. We have some critical information, not critical, but we have some important information based on your recent study, based on your recent lab. And then the patient can often log in on their mobile device and actually access that information securely. So even just that communication has really gotten enhanced with these devices.
Our communication and our practice has been enhanced since we've been using the email capabilities, which is secure. It's linked to their medical record. It's beautiful because I can answer that wherever I am. I just have to log on. But to be able to access that information from a patient's phone or to be able to put in some of their history before they come to the doctor, there are so many ways that we could use this electronic health record and make it more accessible to patients. But there's some debate over how much the patient should see of their medical record.
That is an ongoing debate, as well as, you know, who really owns the medical information, who owns that medical record. I think these debates will continue. But for the time being, my hope is that we will see more research looking at ways to leverage that information to really improve patient care.
I can see a nice clinical trial going on in our minds here, thinking and plotting. But let me ask you one final question, and then maybe you can also suggest a website if they want to find out more information. Just speak for 1 second about privacy. What recommendations do you have to safeguard privacy?
I think the key is that both the patient as well as the provider needs to remember that no personal health information should just be sent via email or text message. It has to be safeguarded. If you've got any kind of information like that on your phone, you should have a password on your phone, and everything has to go through an encrypted portal. And I think that's the key message that a lot of people are not adhering to, but it's something that's very critical today.
That is good, good advice.
And the website? A website if they want to find out more information?
Sure. I mean, one of the sites that I maintain is called medicalsmartphones.com, and I think people can find a variety of information there as well as examples of some of the trends that are going on in the industry.
Well, that's great. We appreciate that. Thank you so much for talking with us and sharing some really important tips, and perhaps be with us again as this technology changes.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Dr. Kim. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. On House Call segment of our show today, we're going to talk about your health questions and concerns.
And if you have a question you'd like for us to address on an upcoming show, you can send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And now we'll take a few questions from our listeners.
What's our very first House Call?
What are some warning signs of junior diabetes and adult diabetes?
This is a great question about the warning signs of diabetes. And I guess first, Adam, we should talk about type 1 and type 2 diabetes, because it's no longer just children get one type and adults get another.
Yeah, in general, we talk about the type that requires insulin, the type 1 diabetic. And if they don't have insulin because their body doesn't produce it anymore, they really get really sick pretty quickly and will end up in the hospital versus the type 2.
In type 2, it's more in overweight individuals and has to do with the insulin in your body being resistant to that insulin. So you might have enough insulin in your body, but the cells don't react to it because of, usually related to how much extra weight you're carrying around.
But because sometimes younger kids, even today, can be really obese, they can easily get this type 2 diabetes. And you can even have an older person who gets type 1 diabetes. It's not black and white here, but the signs are typically not too dissimilar sometimes, which is, you know, people start feeling poorly.
Yeah, you can get really thirsty. A lot of times you're urinating more because there's so much sugar in your blood that it makes you urinate more. In kids, that could even be bedwetting. Can lose weight.
You might even get an infection because your immune system's a little changed, and that infection can actually also tip your body over. So a urinary tract infection could be the tip-off to a new onset diagnosis of diabetes.
You could have blurry vision and feel tired. But a lot of times with adult diabetes, we find it because they come in for their physical, and we do a screening test that helps pick it up before you get to having all those symptoms.
Yep. So there's no real sign out there that says you're about to get get diabetes, but certainly if you're overweight, your body mass index is over 30, should be on the lookout for trying to reduce it to cut down and eliminate that risk.
Absolutely. Okay, what do we have as our next house call?
So I'm a student at UNC, and one of my group members is getting sick. So if I hang around her and I had the flu shot, am I also going to get sick?
Thank you. Good question.
Yeah, thanks for the question. And you know, I think the answer is we don't know. If you're hanging around someone that's sick that truly has the flu and you got your flu shot early in the season, then probably you won't get the flu. You might get a mild case of a flu-like illness. But if you don't know what your friend had, so if she had a whole host of so many different viruses out there, then sure, you can get sick from her.
Yeah, you know, one thing that's nice, though, is that flu shots do give general protection against a lot of other kind of upper respiratory, about 20% protection. And, you know, look at doctors. You know, doctors do get sick, but they're around so many sick people this time of year, and most of them stay pretty healthy. So I think you can get your cue from maybe a lot of doctors that stay pretty healthy despite being around sick people all the time. You know, wash your hands.
That's what I was going to say. The only thing I could say, most important thing we could
say. Top three things.
Wash your hands, get the flu shot every year early in the season, and wash your hands again.
Well, you know, that's hopefully that's helpful for you. And Chris, you know, our next house call is actually one that was emailed to us, and so we're going to need to read it, but I think it's something that we want to at least acknowledge on the air. So we're going to read this particular one, and it comes from a listener who is kind of stuck in the middle of this discussion about Aetna and UNC, this disagreement about contracts, and I think it strikes home about the cost to an individual patient really there. And she says, Dear Your Health, as you know, Aetna and UNC have parted ways. Unfortunately, we switched to Aetna in January precisely because UNC was a provider. We applied, though, for transition of coverage, which lets us be covered under in-network rates for the next 3 months, so maybe things will be okay. But here's the situation. With the out-of-network rates, I pay 30% co-insurance instead of a $40 copay. That could be as much as $1,500 every month because I have cancer and to cover my cancer treatments. With this plan, at some point, I hit a maximum out-of-pocket, twice as high for the out-of-network, but I don't know if it's going to cover 100% after that. I have to pay the entire fee in full upfront, and then I can submit a claim for reimbursement. For the next month, it could be as high as $25,000 due to two cancer treatments, eye surgery, bone, CAT scan, MRI scans. And I know that this is a contract dispute, but it really is affecting me. And I think it'd be real helpful for others just to hear how difficult this is. And she goes on to really just describe the difficulty of that. So first off, thank you so much for sharing what is such a difficult story.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing. And I mean, Adam, it just makes me mad. I mean, especially with something as complicated as cancer treatment, it's not like you can just hop from institution to institution back and forth when your insurance changes.
Yeah, and I know, I understand, Christy. I'm frustrated as much as mad because these are our patients and our listeners out there. And I don't know, Christy and I have not looked into this, and nor do we probably can. We don't know what's right or wrong in terms of a contract dispute, but we do know is that there are real suffering for people
right.
out there. And what we want to try to at least acknowledge is this and to say we need to provide people relief. She went on to tell us that she can't change her insurance coverage until a year from now. So even with a 90-day extension, this year alone, she's going to have significantly higher out-of-pocket costs. So I guess what we would like to say is, first off, we're so sorry for this. This is something that healthcare should not be at a time of life or death decisions for you and your loved ones about cancer care that you need to be. And you've done everything that you needed to do to provide that care that you now are faced with this situation.
The added stress.
Yeah. And maybe for the companies that are listening, for the executives that are involved, let's hopefully get this resolved soon, immediately. And for those who have these significant out-of-pocket costs, let's give them their money back.
Thank you for writing us, and thank you for listening today. We hope we've answered some questions that are important to you and your health. We want you to write us at yourhealth@unc.edu or call us at 919-966-8081.
You can also visit us online at yourhealthradio.org and send us a question on Twitter right now. Go to twitter.com, search for Your Health Radio, send us your question, and we'll read it on our next show.
We'd like to thank the staff of WCHL and the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Joe Kim. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health Radio, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And we'll look forward to talking to you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website, 1360WCHL.com, and click on WCHL On Demand. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360 WCHL. News Talk 1360, WCHL, your home for progressive talk with the Ed Schultz Show, noon to 3, Monday through Friday, only on 1360 WCHL.